For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so last time we began what is going to end up being 3 or 4 weeks of study in this really important section of 2 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9. And I made the point last time, just kind of get you up to speed, that one of the motivating factors behind Paul's second missionary journey and one of the things that he spent a lot of time doing was raising funds from primarily Gentile churches, which is what the Corinthian church largely was, and also the churches in Galatia, which is basically modern Turkey, all over the place, for the meeting of the needs of the beleaguered community in Jerusalem who were suffering famine. And this was viewed as a very important thing by Paul, and he talks about it in both of the letters we have in the New Testament to the Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 16, which we'll talk about in a little bit, and 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9. It's a big deal because this is a concrete way for Paul to say, you know, when we talk about reconciliation between people, and peoples could not be more alienated than Jews and Gentiles in the first century world. If there is a God who reconciles people, then why not use this opportunity to show that all of the divisions that separate people are eliminated when people are reconciled with God? And so, with this in mind, then, Paul went to all these Gentile churches out through the empire, and he called upon people to respond to the love of God by being generous in meeting this need for the people down there in Jerusalem. And we're going to talk in a couple of weeks about the super strong effect that this was envisioned to have among the people in Jerusalem. But tonight what we want to talk about is kind of where we left off last time, which is that when Paul talks about generosity and this idea of really sacrificing to meet the pressing needs of other people around, that he's really not calling on us to do something that is contrary to our best interest. And last time we were together, if you'll recall, we had this discussion, we had a panel, we had some people talking about the challenge of wealth and how in a world like ours, something like wealth is really not value neutral at all. It's like, you know, the kind of thing where, yes, it is capable of doing a lot of good, and it does do good. But also, in our world, the pull of money and the kind of sacrifices people are willing to make for their families, their own well-being, to secure more and more whenever there is enough, you know, is really the dominant pathology in our culture. Some people call it affluenza. We're suffering from affluenza. We have, but it's never enough. And so we talked in real practical ways last time about what does it look like to engage our boss at work and to set appropriate boundaries for not becoming obsessed and sucked in and this type of thing. And what does it look like, you know, to be able to steward our resources, to be at work and fully present when we're there, and at the same time be able to say at the end of the day, I'm out of here because I've got other things that I'm about, not just that. So I thought that was a really important discussion. I'm really glad for the people that were willing to stand up and to share their experiences. I know that quite a few others could have done that as well. But I think that is the kind of thing that makes this church what it is. And I'm real excited about that. Tonight we want to talk in slightly more positive terms about what does it look like to live generously and why would we do that. The text is 2 Corinthians 8, verses 7 to 21, and let's just dive right in. Paul says, since you excel in so many ways in your faith, your gifted speakers, your knowledge, your enthusiasm, and your love for us, I want you to excel also in this gracious act of giving. I'm not commanding you to do this, but I'm testing how genuine your love is by comparing it with the eagerness of the other churches. You know the generous grace of our Lord Jesus Christ. Though he was rich, yet for our sakes he became poor, so that by his poverty he could make you rich. wow, this is a really rich passage. And what Paul really distills here is the driving motivation behind a life of generosity. What is the motivation that Paul appeals to? Well, look at it. He says, since you excel in so many ways, and this was a very gifted group, apparently. The Corinthians were affluent, and with affluence comes influence, comes culture, comes education, things like that. He says, I want to make sure that you don't lapse in the thing that really matters, which is really our ability to step up there and meet these pressing needs in the people in Jerusalem. And he says, here's why. You know the generous grace of our Lord Jesus Christ. Though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that you might, by his poverty, become rich. That is the motivation. That is the only sustainable motivation behind a lifestyle of really outward-focused generosity towards other people. That I can't think of anything else. Let's talk about that just a little bit. The basis of our generosity is God's generous grace. Let's think about that. Why not be selfish? Have you ever asked yourself that question before? Am I the only one who has thought, you know, why not live for me? Why not let things come my way? Why not do what I want to do, when I want to do it, with whom I want to do it, how I want to do it? What about the fact that, why not? To say, I think self is really what matters. And I think that being selfish is okay. You know, that's a pretty consistent message, actually, in our culture. Something that if we don't have a conscious answer for, I think, as Christians, we will not be able to effectively live a generous life. You know, when there are trains of thought that are just powerfully directing our culture and we have no answer for them, subtly they undermine, they begin to erode the foundations of our convictions, we find that we are really not able to give ourselves wholeheartedly because we've got things in the back of our minds. Why not just be selfish? There's reasons for that. You know, natural selection is not generous. You look out at the animal kingdom, and you look at the lion stalking its prey in the African tundra, and that lion isn't saying, I wonder what's in the zebra's best interest today. Wonder how I could really lay down my life and serve the interest of that zebra. You know, but see, the thing is that the dominant view in our culture is that all human beings are is a more complicated version of that lion out on the plain. And that all you are is a very sophisticated bag of chemicals. You're driven by the same basic impulses as any other animal. There's no room for generosity and selflessness in the animal kingdom. And so, really, we're asking kind of a philosophical starting point type question here. Who are we? If we are a bag of chemicals, if we are not the creation of a personal God and we bear his image, well then, you know, really, there is no basis for us to talk about generosity at all. So, that's important. Karma, you know, think about from the Eastern point of view. Evolutionary theory is a Western kind of thing, and the extension of that in terms of an ethic. Karma is the Eastern idea. It's the cosmic law of cause and effect. It says basically what happens to you is the product of the things that you do. And, you know, if you did good, then good things come back to you. If bad things are happening to you, it's because of something you did earlier in your life, at another life, whatever it is. But you know what? Karma is not generous. You get what you deserve. Now, if a person is really suffering in a significant way, maybe they just don't even have enough food to feed their family. And so things are going really bad for these people. And you have really embraced this idea that the governing principle of the universe is karma. What do you say about that family? They deserve it. They are, you know, in fact, for me to interfere would be in some way perhaps to agitate the balance of the universe. It's to say that it's preventing them from experiencing the consequences of their bad choices and burning off their karma to that extent. And so it is true. It's interesting. When you go to the East, where this idea is truly embraced, it's not a generous culture. I've been there. I've seen it. It's very interesting. I've talked to Indians who have come to the United States, for instance, and they'll talk about what do they know about Christianity. And the one thing that they kind of consistently say is, well, you know, I was born in St. such and such hospital, and I was educated in this Christian school's Christian church's school and so forth. And what they know about Christianity is the acts of generosity that have been extended to them, and it's simply not present in their own culture. So I don't want this just to be a abstract and academic discussion, but I think it's very important that we take real stock of what Paul is saying here, that the basis of any kind of real generosity has to be in the person of who God is. Any other basis, and we simply will not be able to have that foundation that will enable us to make the sacrifices to be generous people. It just doesn't exist. In fact, some people would say, hey, selfishness is good. It brings out the best in people, you know, right? If I don't rely on you and you don't rely on me, we're just left to our own devices, what's going to happen? You know, I'm going to be better off because I'm not going to look to you or anybody else to have my needs met. And so there's a whole philosophy about that. Maybe some of you have read Ayn Rand, you know, The Fountainhead and stuff like that. She was really big years ago. I suppose maybe probably still is, because people still are selfish and are looking for justifications for their selfishness. It's a failed system. Let's talk about the generosity of God. Paul says in Romans 8, verse 32, a parallel to what he's saying here really gives the content of what he's alluding to. He says, he who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us, how will he not also with him freely give us all things? Wow, what kind of a God do we have? We have a super generous God. Okay, so, you know, Dave was singing this song, Lord of the Starfields, you know, just this idea that we've got an awesome, all-powerful creator God, that nothing has come into being outside of his willing it to exist. And so the power, the intelligence of God, the only eternal being that there is, you know, you would think that a being like that would say, how can I create toys for myself to amuse me throughout my eternity? But no, that's not what God does. What God is motivated by is the thought that he could create beings that reflect his personhood for the purpose then of coming along and relating to them, and when need arises, to serve those needs. And so Paul says here that the needs and your poverty and mine became so dire in the eyes of God that God himself was willing to say, look, what is it going to take to exercise my generosity to meet the pressing needs that human beings have? Well, it turns out that what it took was his own son. Wow, his own son. See, the human condition from the Bible's point of view is really bad news. On the one hand, yes, we are valuable in the eyes of God. We're the image of God, regardless of what we do with our lives. But at the same time, there's a tragic, profound problem that we have, and which is that we are so devoted to self at any cost that we have shut out the leadership of God in our lives, the leadership of God in our relationships, that we have really come to the lowest common denominator, which is basically, you know, what's in it for me? And that way of living, the Bible calls sin. Sin is saying, no, I answer to me. I'm about my agenda, my thing, whatever that thing is. And, you know, God says you've got the freedom to live that way. You can do that. But you're not free with respect to the consequences, which is that your will that resists me alienates me from you. And so we don't have anything real going on. And as I created you as an eternal being, we look at this situation and we see alienated people spiraling out of God's orbit for an eternity. The source of all goodness and truth, eternally separated and alienated from God. And God's like, you know, that circumstance, that situation, that's not acceptable to me. I want to do something about that. And what he was prepared to do was to enter into the world himself in the person of Christ. That's what the incarnation is. It's God becoming a human being and living as a man. And ultimately, for the purpose of taking upon himself your guilt and my guilt, the guilt of all of humanity, fell upon Jesus Christ. And in one moment, as he screams in agony from the cross, "Tetelestai, it is finished." What God is saying is, in the death of my son, he died the death that all of humanity stands under for my judgment. And he has taken it in your place. That is generous. That you can't be more generous than to give your own life in this way. And so that's why the cornerstone of the Christian message is grace. In the Greek, charis, it means gift. Or as an acronym, grace means God's riches at Christ's expense. You know, if you can be reconciled to the all-powerful, all-loving God of the universe, and you have the opportunity to relate to him, to have him in your life now and forever, you know, you're going to have a long time to experience the riches of God's goodness. I know that there are just scores and scores of people here tonight who can say, man, God did meet me at my place of great poverty and real alienation from him, and he has changed my life and sort of as a foretaste of what eternity with him is going to be about. Grace is a gift. What God was willing to do is an offer set before you, but like any gift, you have to respond to that. You have to say, yes, I realize I'm impoverished. I realize I'm distant from God. And I'm prepared to trust that what God did in Christ is sufficient to reconcile me to him. And that's what it means to be a Christian. And this is something that these Corinthians, they understood that. They got that message. And now they're looking to what God has done in Christ and saying, how do I then apply that to my own circumstance in life? How do I become more like what Christ did? Because that's obviously, if that's God's way in the face of suffering, in the face of need in the world, to live a life of life-giving self-sacrifice, that's the challenge before us. Let's think about that. God's got this awesome offer on the table, and he's calling on us to respond to his generosity. Let's think about this from a couple different points of view. There's a very unnatural picture of what does it look like to respond to God's generosity in Matthew 18, verses 23 to 25. And since it's kind of a long piece, I didn't want to put it on the overhead. And instead, we're going to have Al. Just give us a read, Al.
Therefore, the kingdom of heaven can be compared to a king who decided to bring his accounts up to date with servants who had borrowed money from him. In the process, one of the debtors was brought in who owed him millions of dollars. He couldn't pay. So his master ordered that he be sold, along with his wife, his children, and everything he owned, to pay the debt. But the man fell down before the master and begged him, "Please be patient with me, and I will pay it all." Then his master was filled with pity for him, and he released him from him and forgave his debt. But when the man left the king, he went to a fellow servant who owed him a few thousand dollars. He grabbed him by the throat and demanded instant payment. His fellow servant fell down before him and begged him for a little more time. "Be patient with me, and I will pay it," he pleaded. But his creditor wouldn't wait. He had the man arrested and put in prison until the debt could be paid in full. When some of the other servants saw this, they were very upset. They went to the king and told him everything that happened. Then the king called in the man and he had forgiven and said, "You evil servant, I forgave you that tremendous debt because you pleaded with me. Shouldn't you have mercy on your fellow servants just as I had mercy on you?" Then the angry king sent the man to prison to be tortured until he paid his entire debt.
So it didn't turn out so well for that guy. But the point that Jesus is making in this parable is a really poignant one. He says in verse 33, "I forgave your debt because you asked. Should you not also have mercy on your fellow slave in the same way that I had mercy on you?" And you just have this instinctual revulsion to a person like that. This dude was in debt up to his eyeballs. Millions of dollars, it says. Millions. And the master just said, "Okay, fine. You're forgiven." But then this same guy who's been forgiven that huge debt sees this other person who owes him a few bucks and, you know, takes him by the throat and pay up. And the hypocrisy, the incongruity of that is so shocking that Jesus says, you know, anybody who really understands that you have really been forgiven a mountainful will really turn around with the same generosity that God extended to you, and you will extend that to others as well. That's just, you know, the way it works. And a really beautiful picture of this, I think, comes in Luke chapter 7, verses 40 to 50. Rob, why don't you give us a read?
Then Jesus answered his thoughts. "Simon," he said to the Pharisee, "I have something to say to you." "Go ahead, teacher," Simon replied. Then Jesus told him the story. "A man loaned money to two people, 500 pieces of silver to one and 50 pieces to the other. But neither of them could repay him, so he kindly forgave them both, canceling their debts. Who do you suppose loved him more after that?" Simon answered, "I suppose the one for whom he canceled larger debt." "That's right," Jesus said. Then he turned to the woman and said to Simon, "Look at this woman kneeling here. When I entered your home, you didn't offer me water to wash the dust from my feet, but she washed them with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You didn't greet me with a kiss, but from the time I first came in, she has not stopped kissing my feet. You neglected the courtesy of olive oil to anoint my head, but she has anointed my feet with rare perfume. I tell you, her sins, and they are many, have been forgiven, so that she has shown me much love. But a person who is forgiven little shows only little love." Then Jesus said to the woman, "Your sins are forgiven." The men at the table said among themselves, "Who is this man that he goes around forgiving sins?" And Jesus said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace."
All right, thanks. Another really poignant picture, very different from the first one. He says to the woman, "She who has been forgiven much loves much, and he who has been forgiven little loves little." And that is sort of the test that Paul is bringing to these Corinthians. He said, you know, we got these other groups like the Macedonians and like these other groups we talked about last time. They were poor, but they really ponied up in a generous way because they really understood something deep about God. And now you also need to go back to the real foundation of your faith. If you have been the recipient of God's generous love by way of his forgiveness and his ongoing care for your life, then it will be natural for you, the natural impulse, when treated in this kind of way is to want to share that and to want to be like that. And so he says, the person who's been forgiven much, you know, they get it. They understand what's really important and they're prepared to do whatever. And the person who just is self-contented and like these Pharisees were, they don't sense that they really need to be forgiven. And the fact is, they don't love. There's a big connection in the Bible between love and grace. And if we don't get that, we're not going to get very far and we're not going to be generous people. Let's press on because I want us to be a little bit practical here tonight. I want to talk a little bit about what some of the practical responses to becoming generous would be. He says in verse 10, here's my advice. It would be good for you to finish what you started a year earlier. Remember, the Corinthians were the first group, apparently, to step forward and say, count on us. We're going to be raising those funds for these people who are in famine in Jerusalem. Last year, he says, before you were the first one to give, and you were the first to begin to do it. Now you should finish what you started. Let the eagerness you showed in the beginning be matched now by your giving. Give in proportion to what you have. Whatever you give is acceptable if you give it eagerly. So this becomes then a very important paragraph where that principle of generosity that God demonstrated towards us then gets applied to our lives in a tangible way. What is he saying? Here are the keys to financial freedom so that we're not just living for self and living for bucks and generosity. He says, you were the first ones who wanted to give. You were the first ones who began doing it. There's a real intentionality to their giving. You know, maybe some of us are accustomed to being swayed by, you know, images on TV where you see this really pathetic child usually, and a guy comes on and says, you know, don't you care? Aren't you a loving person? You're rich. Surely this matters to you. Give. And what does Torg do? Oh, yeah. And he grabs his credit card out of his wallet and calls the 1-800 number, and boom, he's pledged. No, he doesn't do that. Hardly any of us do, because impulse doesn't work. And that's a good thing. We're not supposed to be manipulated by our feelings. It's rather that we make a decision and that we're intentional about it. These guys were that way, you know, that they had thought it through and they had connected the principles that God is a generous God. The principle that to demonstrate the reality of God to a world that is lost and confused would occur as people who have historic hostilities sit down and serve in this concrete way. They understood those principles. And they begin to connect then those principles with the resources that they really did have. And I think that kind of objectivity is extremely important. That giving in this sense is planned. It wasn't impulsive at all. And Paul sent a delegation to Corinth, like he did to all these other churches, to say, hey, here's the situation. Let's pray about this. Let's talk this through. Let's see if this church is willing to join in with all these other churches in this great thing. And then, having made that agreement, the Corinthians went to planning. In the first letter, in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, Paul puts it this way. He says, regarding your question about the money being collected for God's people in Jerusalem, he says, you should follow the same procedure I gave to the Galatians. He says, on the first day of each week, you should each put aside a portion of the money you have earned. Don't wait until I get there and try to collect it all at once. And so what is this? Again, this is planned giving. This is not at the end of the week. He says at the beginning of the week. What's the significance of that? By the end of the week, there ain't nothing left. You're done. Okay. But at the beginning of the week, where you still have your hard-earned cash in hand that you haven't blown from the weekend, then he says you put some of that away. Whatever you've purposed in your heart, whatever you've agreed is the right thing to do, put that aside. And so there was this whole strategy of planned giving that he's bringing back to their attention here. He's saying, let's remember to do that so that when we come down to collect this cash, it's not like, oh my God, Paul's coming, hurry quick. You know, grab a few denarii and throw it in the thing. You know, he wants these people to be ready because the thing that they are really trying to fund matters, and it matters to God. And so that idea of planning, I think, is really crucial to work out within the structure of our families a real consensus where we are able to talk as a married couple, and I think also sometimes bringing kids into this discussion is valuable as well. We've done that. Where you agree, this is what we're all about as a family. This is what we value. This is what we want to live for. This is what we've got. Now, what would it look like then for us to take the example of Christ and to live generously in this way. And I think that those conversations are just absolutely life-changing. It changes the way your family functions. It changes the way you relate to one another. The idea of putting your money where your mouth is a very transforming thing. And it's also, I think, sometimes a very difficult thing. I don't know about you, but, when I think about generosity, I think, I've got a kid in college. I got a kid in private school. I've got a mortgage to pay. I've got a life to live. I am not rich. And all these things are competing for my 2 cents worth. I just don't know that it's realistic or even appropriate for me to think, about a plan of giving, maybe getting involved in a pledge program or something that's concrete and specific like this. That's very confrontive to what we're about and how we think. There is a family that I've known a little bit, mostly from a distance. But they're kind of a lot like a lot of us. They don't have tons of money just laying around. And they have yet learned in that context to live a life of substantial generosity. I want to introduce you to the Family Stone. You're going to have to get that volume way up.
Well, the first real conviction was when our friends went off to the mission field, Fritz and Marianne, were heading over to Russia. They were asking for donations, and we never even considered going. I mean, that was way too hard and scary, but we thought, well, we could give up cable and give the cost to them.
Yeah, ESPN was hard to give up, but the really cool part was having this discussion with the Juskalians about what they were doing and where they were going and what their plan was and how we could become a part of that.
Well, I think Pat was ready to give from the beginning, but I always was very cautious about a negative impression of churches, the televangelists that want your money, and I had a really bad taste in my mouth, so giving to our missionary friends seemed a great thing. I knew exactly what the money was going to. I knew who was handling it.
My wife has a great ability to be able to manage our money. She's done a great job with however little we made. She's always done a really great job of being able to manage it, making it go the farthest, using it in the wisest areas. And I'm kind of the opposite.
As we grew together spiritually and trusted God more, both as a couple and, me trusting him as the spiritual leader of the family, then it was easier for me and to follow his lead in really wanting to give.
I had the passion, but didn't have the direction of how to do it. She was really, she could put a direction on that passion. We have a great relationship to be able to temper one of each other's personalities. But we both have the same passion to be able to see God's work done.
There's sacrifice in giving. I mean, it took 10 years of living in this house before we could afford to put in a real kitchen. We were, it's an old campus house, and we were running upstairs because the kitchen downstairs was pretty much trashed, and the upstairs one still worked. So, my husband's a chef, and yet we couldn't afford it, so it just took a lot of time before we could actually make the house really functional.
Yeah, that was difficult. There's vacations we never took. There's maybe new clothes that I could have bought, or some new equipment for work or whatever, some other things. The list goes on. We can always find other things that we could need or use or replace. Everybody's got them. But in this case, I think that we were able to work with the things that God had given us, no matter how difficult, and still be able to be great. I think we found ways to be really still great hosts in our house. If we hadn't seen things happen, not just in our lives, but other people's lives, and people in much worse situations still giving, if we didn't have a working example in our lives to see in other people's lives, then I think it would have been very difficult for us to make that decision. I think we may have decided, and maybe rightfully so, to put in that kitchen. It would have been okay. But I think also seeing how other people in worse situations than we've had be able to continue giving.
It's a greater trust and greater faith. I mean, there have been a lot of times I've been really nervous and just worried about bills and, you know, can we afford this or are we going to make it this month? And, you know, strange things happen, especially when you pray about them. I mean, God has a way of coming through with the funding. I didn't expect that material things would be that meaningless anymore. I mean, you know, that doesn't mean I don't still want things. I do. I mean, you look through the Sunday flyers or things like that, and, you know, ooh, I could really use this. But, you know, when it comes right down to it, like Pat said, the things I really value are friends and relationships, and the stuff is way less important, and that's kind of cool because that's as it should be.
I think it's just an incredible joy that you get being able to see your money used in such positive ways. So easy in the culture that we live in to buy the latest thing that you want, which is cool. Like I said, we all like that. We all want to do that. And sometimes it's great, but to be able to see people's lives changed by you giving, you sacrificing the money that you make, and the joy that you get to see lives changed and God working in your neighborhood, in your city, just giving you that opportunity to serve Him. It's really cool.
It is cool, and they're really cool too. And I just think that there's a whole lot in what they had to say that is super significant. This is a couple who came together. They became Christians well into their adult life. They really thought it through. What are we about? What are we prepared to do? And they have found a way, and they're very creative, just like a lot of us, and finding a way to really live an outwardly focused, generous life that includes generous financial giving as well. And it's sweet to see that kind of consensus form in a family environment. They're intentional. What else does the passage tell us? What about the idea of being faithful? He says, look, you said you were going to do this. Let's finish what you started. Finish what you started. Don't just tell us what you're going to do. Do what you say you're going to do. And I think this is a very important piece. It's very easy to feel like, you know, yeah, that's right. I should be living a generous life. I should be giving. But then there's competition for that commitment. And like she said, you open the flyer on Sunday and there's a hole, man. You know, I've been thinking about this a lot. I listen to stereo equipment that's probably as old as some of you here. And the new stuff they have out makes my old stuff look like crap. And I just think, you know, there's got to be a reason for me to buy something like this. I know, I'm turning 50 this year. That's the reason. You know, or whatever it is. There are things that are going to compete for a commitment that you make. Some kind of must-have, you know, device or vehicle or something like that. And, you know, it's just a fact that if you want to live generously, we have an opposition, a spiritual personality who's wanting you to say no to that commitment. And there is a powerful stream, a spiritually vital stream, opposing God's purposes in our lives becoming generous. And we have to expect that when we extend ourselves in this way, that there will be all kinds of, like, what are you doing? I can't believe you did this. I have friends who were very, very generous as a couple. They made a fairly substantial salary, but they were also very generous in what they give. And they were into the six figures in giving to things that God was doing. And, you know, they got out at a certain point, and their commitment exceeded their understanding. And all kinds of things begin to compete then for, you know, what are you doing? You could be going to somewhere in the Caribbean, you know, that's really nice for vacations a lot, and you could be having this and that. And it profoundly hurt their marriage that they didn't have resolution to these questions. And I think that that's just something that you can expect. If you want to live generously, you're going to get flack for it. The evil one will make you pay. He says, give in proportion to what you have. And so here's the principle of proportionality. What does it mean? Well, let's think about this. What is truly sacrificial? Giving in proportion to what you have. If I am Arnold Schwarzenegger, and I give $100,000, is that generous? Well, I think it's generous. I mean, that's a lot of money, right? But not compared to what he has. So it's generous, but is it sacrificial? It is not sacrificial. There's no proportion at all from what this guy brings in and what he is willing to give to others. And so the idea of if our template is the generous love of God embodied in the sacrifice of Christ, I want to tell you something. That's cutting really into the meat of the fingernail at that point. That's real pain. That's real sacrifice for the pressing needs of other people. And so we really need to think about, if that is the framework, then whatever we do, and it is up to us, as he will later say, you know, it's our conscience before God, but if we are arriving at a way of living that mirrors what God is really all about, it's not going to look like formulations like the Old Testament tithe. Maybe some of us are familiar with this, you know, this idea that in the Old Testament there was a temple tax. It was 10% of a person's financial resources, and that included not just money, but other things as well. And so that's kind of looked at as like that's the template or whatever. And it's interesting that the notion of tithe never really even occurs in the New Testament. I'm only aware of one usage of it, and it's negative from Jesus' point of view. And so that's not really what's being called for here, not some percentage that we should all agree to and sign off on or whatever, but a generosity, a sacrificial kind of giving that is proportional to the real resources that we have available to us. Which means then that we are going to have to make a shift in our thinking. In our culture, we believe that I earned it, it's mine. Okay, and there is certainly a certain sense in which that's true. You did earn it, and it's in your account. But from a biblical point of view, we are not sovereigns of our possessions any more than we are sovereigns of our own lives. And so what we need to be is stewards of our resources. That's why the metaphor of a steward is used so commonly in the New Testament. Jesus appeals to it on numerous occasions. Paul does as well. And it's the idea that God, you know, you think, well, you know, I'm just such an industrious person. I've just gone out there and I've worked myself to the bone. I've done the work and it's mine. That's our way. Well, God would have us think about it from this framework. Namely, who gave you that great mind? Did you go out and earn that personality? Oh, I know. You really thought it through when you would exist and where you would exist and the resources that would be at your disposal. Right? Of course not. Those were given to you. You had nothing to do with that. All you did is open the door that was right before you. You know, I don't want to diminish the accomplishments that people make in life. That matters. Absolutely matters. But to say that I just did it all my way is a lie. It's a foolish lie. It's not true. And you have been granted a moment in time. You've been granted a place on the earth. You've been granted the personal resources that you have to be able to acquire wealth, like everything else that you acquire. But you are stewards because the earth is the Lord's and all it contains. It's not yours. And so we need to think very creatively about what does it mean for me to be a wise steward in proportion to what God has entrusted to me. And then he says, finally, in verse 12, whatever you give is acceptable if you give it eagerly. And so here, there's this principle of being zealous about giving. Oh, man, you got to be kidding me. A lot of us think about giving like you know, paying our IRS bill. Like, oh, you know, it's like some kind of a unwelcome necessity or something like that. But Paul's like, you know, no, God loves a cheerful giver. Whatever you give is acceptable if you give it with eagerness. And so there's this idea that not only is God saying, you know, you need to be sacrificial, but you've got to be really excited about it. So here's my question. Let's have a little bit of discussion just for a couple of minutes. How does generosity energize us spiritually? Let's think about that just a little bit. Who has a thought about this? When you are willing to live generously, how does that energize you spiritually? What do you think? Over here, Jeff's got his hand up.
Well, I was just thinking as you're talking, just how many times I've been blown away by how, I don't know what to call it, open-minded sort of God's view of money is, how it lacks in coercion, really. Everything in the Bible talking about money talks about the getting behind what God is getting behind. You know, God values people. God values eternity, you know, getting behind those things. And money is often really just a reflection of priorities and things that you want to get done. And so, at least in my life, making decisions about, okay, I'm going to get behind this thing because I really believe in this, and then giving my money to it, come right behind it comes lots of excitement of participating in it.
Yeah.
Or if I'm generous with my friends or my neighbors or whatever, and I see that puts a smile on the face of somebody that I've been generous with, I'm excited about that. And it just helps me align with what I think God's goals and priorities are. I mean, I think there's an initial ascent to it anyhow, but then as I give my money to it, excuse me, and just continue to be committed to it, I find that I can really identify with what God identifies with there.
Okay,
I can value
good.
What he values.
So it's that sense, like Jesus said, where your treasure lies, there will your heart lie also. So where you are investing, it draws your heart into that. I think that's exactly right. And that does produce that kind of energized sense, that fresh kind of sense that, man, God's really at work. I'm a part of that, and it's really sweet. Good. Who else has a thought? Tord?
Yeah, my thoughts went along really the same kind of lines as his, but the way I was thinking about it is that, you know, personally, I only have so many opportunities for impact in other people's lives directly, and I realized at a point that the money I gave let me have impact beyond what I could personally do each day, and so the money I give, I'm now participating in somebody else's ministry oftentimes, and I think, wow, I can do it personally, directly, and it can work for me even overnight while I'm sleeping.
I think that's a super important point. It's like, you know, you can get a lot of Christian work done by facilitating other people to get it done. Yo.
I can tell you what happens when you don't.
Okay, well hear that.
Because for a long time, my husband and I, when we were single, we were giving regularly when we lived in the ministry house, and we were part of so many great things, and it was awesome. And when we got engaged, we both decided, well, our income's going to be put together, and we're going to be able to trust God even more, so we're going to up what we're giving. And we thought this through, and we prayed about it, and then nothing but tragedy happened. And it was funny, not giving really created this very isolated thought about money, and in such a way where, like, I've I felt trapped. Like, I felt jailed. Like, every single cent was something that I punished myself for spending, even when it was things that were appropriate. I mean, it was just like, it was something that, because I didn't have anything that I felt like I could freely give, I didn't understand anything that God was personally freely giving me, because I just couldn't get my thought around, this is something that you freely do with a generous heart, and when you don't have that generous heart, you're not going to see that this was a choice you freely made to give back to God.
So maybe God was using that as an opportunity to bring you back to this foundational point we started with, which is, it's about what I've given you. It's all about grace. It's not like I have to, or my acceptability is based upon my giving or things like that.
Yeah, even though at some points people made me feel like it was about that, and that was really kind of crappy, but like what you started with, his riches.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Cool. Anybody, one more thought here in the back?
Well, I think we all have to consider that wealth doesn't just encompass money.
That's right.
It encompasses your time and your heart,
yep,
your two hands, and you all have that to give to your neighbors and your friends, your children, and other people. Mm-hmm. And I think God's wealth is a lot more than just money.
So well said. That's exactly right. It's just a piece of the package of an outwardly focused life. Well said. But I think that that the act of giving, and yes, it's true, the same principle holds, whether it's financial or in other ways, does have an energizing effect. I want to share just a few things that occurred to me as I was thinking about this in relation to my own family life. That first, being generous with our financial resources has made us connect with other people. And this is Torg's point, I think, that I feel like, you know, I know what's happening in places that I can't be. I know what's happening in places that very few of us could live in Southeast Asia, in Africa, other places like that. And I know that people that I'm helping to resource are saving lives, are participating in some of the most dynamic Christian work in the world. And there's a sense of privilege. That's Paul's word when talking about the Macedonians, if you'll remember from last week. He says the Macedonians begged with us for the favor of participating in this generous work. And I kind of sense, I understand what that means. Because when you see what you're able to accomplish as a co-laborer of Christ with people in other contexts, that's a very special thing. There is also, as somebody else pointed out, a sense of distance from the neurotic pull of stuff. You know, just that feeling that I don't really need all the time. And so, you know, I'm not feeling like I have to just satisfy that ever mounting urge to consume. It's been an important kind of discussion for our kids as well. What we teach and the values that we seek to instill are things that we talk about often, but they're also things that children see parents do. And if we are living outwardly and generously, which includes financially generously, to be sure, kids see that. They understand that's what it means to be a man. That's what it means to be a woman. To be like that. What are the signals that we are sending our kids about what they should do when they have opportunity to share wealth with other people? Are we always fantasizing with them about an acquisition, more stuff, bigger toys, things like this? Are we talking about real principles of stewardship that bring them into the discussion? Here's what Mom and I are doing, and this is where we're at. And yeah, this is why we will not do some of the things that you would like to do, perhaps. But we're committed along these lines. Now, your kids may grow up and say, you know, that was a bunch of crap. I don't want to live for that. I want to live for me, and that would be really tragic. And certainly, it's possible. But at least they will have a framework that they know what you're about. And that will have, I think, a significant effect over the long haul in their lives as well. So those are some thoughts. Here's the last thing we want to end with then. Paul says, Thank God who's given Titus the same enthusiasm for you that I have. Titus welcomed our request that he visit you again. In fact, he was very eager to go and see you. We are also sending another brother with Titus. He was appointed by the churches to accompany us and as we take the offering to Jerusalem, a service that glorifies the Lord and shows our eagerness to help. We are traveling together to guard against any criticism for the way we are handling this generous gift. We are careful to be honorable before the Lord, but also we want to everyone else to see that we are honorable. What is Paul saying? He's saying, look, it matters that we have integrity in this whole money process. And I think that there's a couple things that we need to say by way of closing here, that when we talk about a life of generosity that's corporate in nature, which is what the church is, that accountability is a major biblical value. And certainly Paul is talking about that here. That it, to be skeptical about people's claims about money is prudent, not sinful. Okay? So I got this tearjerker story for you, and won't you please write out a generous check? To which you say, more information. I need a lot more information. That's not good enough. I need to understand, where does this money go? I want to understand how it's distributed. I want to know, what are the overhead costs? I want to know that you have open books. I want to know a lot of things, because I don't trust you. Okay? Do not trust me, please, or anyone here. Because you know what? The allure, the draw of money is just more powerful than any one of us. We are all subject to the possibility of compromise morally in this area. It's prudent to be skeptical, not sinful. Fund groups that are totally open. You know, in America, churches don't have to have open books. There's this thing called separation of church and state. And so it allows religious organizations to amass huge sums of money with no accountability to the broader culture whatsoever. And we can think of that what we want, positively or negatively, and I suppose there's positives and negatives about it. But here's the deal. That if you are giving, I think, in a biblical way and being obedient to this principle that Paul speaks of here, you want to know where that money is going, what kind of organization this is, and do they practice open accounting? Are their books accessible to you? That's been one of the interesting questions as we've gone out to other third world contexts and interacted with agencies that are doing phenomenal work in India and in Cambodia and places like that. The one question that we have asked them if they to consider the future of a partnership is, are your books open to us? Can you show us that the money that we send goes to where it's supposed to go? And, you know, I'm really pleased to say that the organizations that we have gotten behind in this fellowship practice that kind of open accounting, as do we. And it is possible for you to know what I make as a salary, and most of the employees here make a salary, where our money goes. You can call our accountant, our controller, and he will give you a breakdown at whatever level of specificity you want. And I'm not saying that to say, you know, aren't we great or whatever. What I'm saying is, if we don't do that, I think that we're sinning and we're violating this important principle that Paul established. We've got to be open, totally. That we want to entrust the people who are above reproach, you know, people who are really honest and can be trusted with this kind of cash, and then to not trust them in the final analysis, but have someone looking over their shoulder. Notice Paul has a group of people who are doing this. Non-Christians and people not committed to the group should not feel any sense of obligation to give. This is to the church. And it goes here for you tonight. We're going to be passing the hat here in a minute, or like right now. And if you're not a part of this fellowship, you don't know really where you're at with this whole Christianity thing, just pass that thing by. It's not really for you, and we don't want you to feel uncomfortable about it. And finally, Biblical giving is anonymous giving. Sorry, nothing is going to be named after you in this fellowship. There will not be, you know, the Rob Memorial Chair or, you know, anything like that. It's just not going to be like that. Anyway, here are some principles. It's just, I think, some practical stuff about what does it look like for us to cultivate a life of generosity. Let's pray together. Lord, just thank you so much for your great generosity. Thank you that while we were far from you, while we were alienated, while we had nothing to bring to the table, you came in the person of Christ and you laid down your life for us. And I just want to thank you for that, Lord. I pray that you'd help us to say, what does that mean then? If that's the foundational truth of the universe, what does that mean for my life, my family? And for some of us here tonight, what does that mean about where do I stand before God? And I just pray, Lord, for those of us who are kind of thinking this whole Christianity thing through, that this would be that time where we really put some pieces together and realize, you know, God's not asking me to be a better person or more generous or whatever. He's asking me to recognize my poverty and my deep need for his mercy, and that he supplied that to me freely in the person of Christ. Just pray, Lord, that that message would seep in and really connect, and that people sensing that need would open their hearts up to you, Lord, and just say, I want you in my life and I want your forgiveness. Thank you for this time. Thank you for this great fellowship. Help us to be generous with one another tonight as we spend some time in fellowship. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.